Hey, welcome to the CMO Whisper Show. I'm your host, Steve Olensky. Part marketing practitioner, part ad agency veteran, part journalist. I was a writer for Forbes for 10 years. I've had so many insightful conversations over the years with business leaders, to athletes, to celebrities, to, of course, CMOs. The only difference now is instead of sharing those insights through written form, I'm doing it this way. This week, I welcome two guests to the show, Rose Gia, an award-winning marketing and product leader who currently heads up lifecycle and launch marketing for Amazon's Prime Video, and Hetal Patel, a seasoned professional with over a decade at iHeartMedia. The conversation we had centered around the growing disconnect between consumers and marketers. Fascinating stuff. Here it is. What an absolute honor to have both of you on the CMO Whisper Show. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. So excited to be here.
Yes, likewise. Thanks, Steve.
The reason we're here, we're going to talk about a recent study late last year that came out. It was a partnership between iHeart and Malcolm Gladwell, and it looked at the growing consumer slash marketer disconnect. This is such a soapbox issue for me. You have no idea. So the research explores the growing disparity between consumer values and behaviors and marketing priorities in the U.S. And guys, I want to jump right into that deep end. And whoever wants to go first, what were some of the findings that really surprised you the most from this research?
It was definitely one of the, you know, most fulfilling research studies or journeys that I've done in a really, really long time. The study was an exciting collaboration, like you teed up, with Malcolm, which is Pushkin Industries, iHeart, and a couple of third-party vendors like Morning Consult and Advertiser Perception. It was the best and the brightest minds in the industry who came together and said, let's look at this consumer marketer divide, right? And the bottom line of that for us was, trust is the currency on which marketing operates. But the only way to establish trust with your consumers is to actually understand what motivates them, what makes them wake up in the morning excited, scared, right? And so that was the premise of this particular piece. I think for me, Steve, sobering enough, the most surprising aspect of this was, we are very different as humans, right? So we went into this with this hypothesis that there is this divide that's happening between consumers and marketers. Marketers think X, but consumers behave Y. While that is true, right? While that is true, at the very core fundamental level, very similar things matter to both groups. So that was very humbling. Like, family was important. You know, health was important. Those things were important and common ground between these two groups. Where differences start to arise is where one group would put education or fame or fortune as more important, while for the other group, it was more family, freedom of speech, and those elements. And now you can guess which one was which. Mm-hmm. So that was, I think, to me, the most surprising element of it. And, you know, I was fortunate to have Rose over when we actually did this event live in iHeart's New York headquarters, where Malcolm, along with a couple of our key executives, actually revealed the study and a few key findings. Rose, what were your reactions, thoughts, anything you'd like to add to what you thought was surprising from there?
Yeah, no, I loved the study and I loved all the insights that you guys have gleaned, and I'm sure we're about to talk about some of them. But I think for me, one of the things that Hetal, you and I had talked about is actually, it just shows the humanness of us all, that, you know, we marketers and consumers at the end of the day, we're all humans, but sometimes marketers forget that when we're thinking about driving business goals. And sometimes we kind of forget that some of the things that we love as a consumer is what the consumers love, but might not be the same thing as what, you know, the business wants us to be doing. So I think one of the things that I really liked was most of the marketers sit in the coasts, at least when we're looking at the US, but then the majority of our consumers are, you know, all across. And sometimes I've been reminded, and I remind my team constantly, like, guys, remind ourselves that we are not necessarily our consumers, and we need to step outside of our, you know, regions and our belief systems and really dig into the data, work with our data teams to understand exactly what do our consumers who are not in our, like, you know, next door neighbors, what do they actually want? So I thought that was really interesting.
I mean, kudos to you, Rose, for recognizing that, because, you know, I always say this, that we as marketers, me included, we live in a bubble. Because like you said, 4 out of 10 marketers live on the coasts and 4 out of 10 consumers per census data live in the South. So that juxtaposition right there, right? But to the point of we all live in our bubbles, but we have even a greater responsibility to break out of that bubble because we are trying to convey and reach people who don't necessarily look like us, but the real true Americans.
Do you think, guys, and this may be the most obvious, and you can slap me virtually when I ask this question, but do you think it's just a matter of sometimes when marketers literally go to work, whether it's virtual or in an office, they just forget and just lose sight of the fact that, hey, I'm also a consumer myself?
I think it's not necessarily that, is that there are competing priorities, right? Mm. As a consumer, we are just consuming. We are taking in what's around us, we're consuming. But then as a marketer, you're not only trying to reach your consumers, you're trying to influence them to do something. And there is a bit of the competing priority is we work for a business and organization that has a specific goal in mind. And I think that is where the disconnect happens, is when a marketer has to basically weigh between what we know consumers want versus what we know we would love for the consumer to do in order to help us with our business. So I think that's where it gets a little bit challenging, but doesn't mean we can't be a lot more customer first. It just means we have to know how to balance it better.
I think that's very well said. You know, Steve, the other way I think about that question that you just asked Rose was like, if I just came off of a party drinking Aperol Spritz, and then when I'm thinking about the next creative in a creative brainstorming session, which requires a drink setup, I'm thinking of an Aperol Spritz without recognizing that 4 out of 10 Americans don't even know what that drink is.
Yep. I know that was one of the findings. And one of for me to answer the same question, and I was completely unsurprised by this, had to deal with NFTs, which we all remember was the hot thing, and how I think it was like 40%, 4 in 10 consumers said they never even heard of them.
Exactly right. And can you imagine the number of man hours that went across conference rooms in America trying to have an NFT strategy?
Right, like, and their productivity and just, but let's use that as a kind of a microcosm, guys, and talk about this. How does that happen? That's a massive disconnect over one thing, but are NFTs a microcosm?
I think it's a little bit of like, you know, I think understanding what trend is pertinent to you versus to your consumer. I'm not saying it's not a trend. It was a trend, but it was a trend for a very niche set of individuals. And when you take that and think that's true of everybody is where the problem starts to arise.
And one thing I'll add is let's not forget that the research is looking at Americans all across, mm-hmm. but the NFT at that moment in time, my understanding was it was directed at a subset of consumers anyways that would have been a lot more amenable to NFTs and were already bought into kind of that side of the world. So I think there is, I would say, trends like that happen where marketers focus on it mostly because they are looking at a subset of customers. Whereas if they try to then expand that to the rest of the customer base, that's where problems happen. It's like you can't take a niche and then try to expand it. And I've seen this happen in a lot of startups where they found their niche. And then when they try to expand to the broader subset, they got in trouble, not in trouble, but it didn't work because
no growth.
Exactly. The niche was a small population that wanted certain things and it didn't scale.
Yeah. It is fascinating. And I do remember, and I'm not saying this at all only because you're on, but I saw that 1/3 of marketers and consumers alike both think radio is cool.
Yes. And that was, you know, not something that iHeart study came out with. That actually stat is from a third party research called as Edison Research, very well known in our circle, mm-hmm. right? So Edison did this piece of work, especially with younger audiences. And there was just a list of different, you know, activities, media types, and they were kind of figuring out what those younger audiences think is cool. And organically, radio came out as cool. I'm not surprised because if you think about young audiences, there's this whole perception of like younger audiences not listening to radio, Steve. And let me just like tackle that head on, right? I think what's old is new with this audience. If you take 100 hours of studying younger audiences, you will recognize why vinyls are getting bought. You will recognize why flip phones are back on the rise, why digital cleanse is going on. Everything that we thought is the millennial generation, the direction it was headed in, the younger generations are erasing some of that. And so it should not surprise you that radio holds the type of resiliency or the cool association, because people forget these guys have to get in the car. There is nothing else happening in the car but radio. Other medias have to be turned on. Radio turns itself on as soon as you get in the car. It has to be turned off. So there's a lot of listening, especially during school drop-off and pickup time, happening with younger audiences. There's a lot of listening.
Yeah, I agree. And I want to segue now into a piece, Atal, you wrote in Ad Age, where you provided five ways to bridge that divide, right? And I'd love to just quickly touch on all five and hear both your thoughts on these tips, these ways to bridge that gap, because the gap's there and it's growing, and if we don't address it, kind of thing. So the first way that you allude to in your piece, Atal, was inspire more, scare less. What did you mean by that one?
I think it's exactly as it sounds. I think if you, again, going back to younger generations for a second, I spend a lot of time understanding different generational cohorts, Steve. And, you know, I think there was a study out there, I want to say it was Morning Consult or Pew Research Center, one of those two, that said Gen Z generation is the loneliest generation in history of all generations. They are extremely lonely. And, you know, the promise of digital that was supposed to bring us closer has actually brought us even further apart as humans. The average number of Americans having a friend is down by 30 or 40%, a close friend. So all across the board, there is a lot of negativity and loneliness that we are feeling as a society. So my first takeaway here is understand what motivates your consumer and inspire them instead of scaring them. That FOMO, or like, you know, I sometimes, not intentionally, but intentionally, we try to create some of these elements that bring us feeling a lot negative. Think about the news cycle that's going on. There is so much negativity at us that finding that feel-good moment is the first takeaway that we came up with from the study, that they are wanting to understand feel-good. They want to feel good. And, you know, one of the things that media and human voice, I think in particular audio, can do really well is make someone feel like you're giving them company and you're comforting them.
Mm. Yeah, 100%. And I would add to that, you know, I've seen some recent studies around just content and the type of content that people, not only in the US, but around the globe, is seeking in the last couple of years is more the feel good, positive, optimistic type of content. Because I think, Atal, you're right. Like, people are tired of hearing, you know, the news cycles are very negative. We just went through, you know, a pandemic. And so I think people are craving more of that like positive energy and that inspirational message versus the, like, let's be fearful of what's going to happen. Because, you know, I think we've all been in fear for 5 years. So I think we're ready for less fear and more inspiration.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's a good segue into the next way that you identified, Atal, in your Ad Age piece. And you wrote, lean into the data more and go where the consumer is. And I want to read a little more what you wrote, because I think it's very important. You said, we've never had more data, but you openly question, are we letting human bias creep in? And you said, the country has to adapt because we're not who we are in 2019, right? And that speaks to what Rose was just saying as well about putting, you know, true customers' need in front of business needs. So how do you do that? How do you put their true customers' needs in front of business needs?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to constantly remind ourselves of, like, if you have, I mean, and I say this to my team, we have to stack rank priorities, period, because, you know, time is limited, resources are limited. And when we do that, the first thing should be, what is it that the customers need, truly need? And then the second thing is, how do our businesses help resolve that, help solve for that, help, you know, make that better? And I think being able to put the customers, just constantly remind ourselves, like, what do they need? What do they want? What is missing to be able to get what they need and want? That's where we come in. And I think putting ourselves in that secondary place of, like, let's help solve that problem is not only going to help us deliver on business goals, but also ensure that we are building for what our customers actually want and need versus what we as a business might think is shiny and cool in a moment. And it would last a lot longer in that way, because then we're actually following what customers truly want at the end of the day.
And, you know, unintentionally sometimes by doing things like that, by ignoring that, you're creating a dynamic where your consumers start to feel alienated from your messaging, right? So you want to make sure you're not doing that just because you think differently than they think, right?
Yeah, they need to know that we know they're human. like we are.
Yes. And actually, some of the things that we've seen in the past that in terms of marketing that's worked really well is what everyone says is like when a brand is authentic, people move towards it. But authenticity is really hard unless the brand is truly being who they are trying to be by being actually just one of the customers, right? And I think that is where, you know, that word gets thrown around all the time. Like, we are trying to be authentic. We are super authentic. But the reality is if every individual in that business is not being customer first, then we are not being authentic. And I think that's where some businesses have really shined because they're just constantly solving for customer problems, like all day, every day. And as a result, that does get to what customers need and bridge that business gap too.
Exactly. The next way, Hital, you wrote in this Ad Age speech, which I can't reference enough, definitely look it up. You wrote, don't get too far ahead, but you also added or behind consumers. So yeah. It's a fascinating dichotomy you use there.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So I think we, you know, sometimes feel as marketers, it's our job to just find what is the new, net, shiny, edgy thing, right? Like we feel this immense pressure to just come up with cool things, right? Which again, I'm not saying should not be the case, but again, that awareness of understanding what of this is my trend versus my consumer's trend. And that's kind of like, you know, part of what we did with the study. We did a really cool exercise where we threw about 60 to 70 different activities, media habits and things at people and said, just sort them in two groups. What's cool to you and what's cringe to you, right? Because what's cool to someone and what's cringe to someone says a lot about that person. And so instead of saying left top two box, bottom two box, we decided to get a little psychoanalytic here, Steve. As you can see, my psychology roots coming to life.
I knew they would at some point.
I am a clinical psychologist at the end of the day, so I gotta think about numbers differently. So you'll notice that what we started to see there was there are trends, and then there were certain aspects that were extremely relevant in the marketing community, but not so much in the consumer community, right? So to make it very real, I'll give two examples. One was a TV show, I'll make it relatable to everybody. Have you both heard of the TV show Succession?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep.
Awesome. So there's almost 100% awareness of that TV show within the marketing community. But 60% of the general population of American consumers did not know about that television show. Did not in my family
probably
alone.
Didn't care either.
Exactly. In my family alone, my husband doesn't know about that show. He doesn't work in marketing. The point I'm trying to make is I still live in the Northeast. He lives in the Northeast too. Just doesn't work in the field and does not subscribe to watching content that aligns with that, right? So there are parts where certain trends apply to certain communities, and we as marketers think that's cool. So now next creative brainstorming session is going to include what we think is cool. And that's kind of where we don't want to get too far ahead as the example. Too far behind, we ask people what they could not live without. And surprisingly, both marketing and the consumer community could not live without snacks. And I think that was hilarious. That's awesome. We are a snacking, you know, driven culture. Yeah. But consumers said the one thing that they could not live without was podcasting. And I was really surprised to hear that. I loved it because we are in the podcasting business, but I promise, like, it was a surprise for me too when I saw that information. But when you think about the clients and the amount of investment going on in podcasting, I still don't see enough. So that's where they're too far behind, right? They're not following the data enough, Steve. They're not following the real trends, not their trends, the consumer trends enough, closely enough, in my opinion.
Yes. And actually, I want to speak to that just a little bit and highlight, Hital, one of the things that you mentioned earlier, which is sometimes marketers are too excited about doing that big new thing that they forget that sometimes the best thing a marketer can do is actually do the what we would consider a boring thing, but it actually does its job. And I think one of the things is, you know, everyone wants the hot new shiny toy. And, you know, we talked about radio. Is old school. It's coming back, right? It's the things that we had before TV, and then now it's like back. And I think sometimes marketers forget that there is the trend of utilizing old is new. And sometimes we need to embrace that more. And I'll give you a quick example of something that happened in my past, in my experience. I won't say the name of the company, but One of the things I noticed, and this happened, was, you know, I was working for a big company. We were launching this massive, massive campaign that was across the US, hundreds of millions of dollars invested in this project. And one of the things, you know, our leadership wanted was something shiny and new. And I was like, actually, we're trying to help small businesses grow. So why don't we actually help them build websites? And then at the bottom of each website, we'll just have a link to our campaign. So that way it's basically, we'll have that attribution. And imagine if thousands of small businesses use this website tool, we're going to have thousands of attribution that, you know, just extends. And I had leadership tell me, that's cool and all, but it's not shiny. It's not newsworthy. No PR is going to pick it up. And I was like, I know, but it's going to be big. It's a sleeper. It's a sleeper cell. You know, we're going to be huge. So we ended up, we still did it, but we didn't want to tell anyone about it. It just became, and we still got the attributions. At the end of the day, I was able to like check the list and be like, thousands of people utilize this website tool. We got that attribution. It worked, but it was like one of those things where I noticed our leadership wanted that shiny new thing versus the thing that we think would have actually done a really good job.
So Rose, sorry to throw you in the bus, but shameless plug here. You've worked with us for a few years now. Yes. And I think the beginning of our relationship was also a very similar dynamic. Would you, without naming anything, would want to talk for a second about how that was also a surprise that you stumbled upon, but like showed you the type of results that you weren't expecting or your stakeholders weren't expecting, because you've been a champion for audio as long as I've known you.
100%. Yes. Well, one, I'm a huge consumer of podcasts. I love podcasts so much. And, but that wasn't the reason. We kind of, this was when I was in grocery, and we knew how important audio was to a customer, especially on their way to go get groceries. Like we know that it's a tried and true type of like, you know, hand in hand type of marketing, but it was really difficult to convince leadership for the investment into audio, especially radio and podcasts, because the return on that investment is really hard to measure. Anything that is not measurable nowadays, if you had asked me 20 years ago, we didn't need necessary measurement. We would have been like, cool, cool, looks good, let's do it. But now, because of the digital age and the assumption that you can get data anywhere, anytime, leadership expects like direct line of attribution from the investments that we make into marketing and the business impacts, so the sales. Mm-hmm. And with audio, we didn't have a proof point. We had most grocery stores do this already. We've seen data that supports like, you know, a lot of consumers are listening like all the time. We had all these data points, but it was so hard to convince leaders. So eventually what we did was we actually started, I mean, and maybe this is a good time for me to plug my book, but you know, one of the things that was really important for me was the best stakeholder that we need to get buy-in wasn't actually marketing leaders. It was actually our finance partners. And the reason is our marketing leaders were looking to finance to say, hey, we're about to invest, you know, X millions of dollars on audio. Like, we're going to do this. You cool with it? And our finance partners, they have the final say because they're trying to balance the whole P&L. So they can say, no, we actually need those millions to plug another hole or to do something else. So that's why I realized we pivoted all of our influencing stakeholder-wise from our marketing leadership to actually our finance leadership. And we basically started putting together lots of, I would say, random math. And Hantal, you and I talked about this. Mm-hmm. We basically said, well, we can't directly measure the impact of audio, but what if we can show correlational that every time we did an audio campaign and we did, and every other marketing that we were doing was like stable, mm-hmm. and we were able to show a lift in search volume during that time for either our business or terms that were part of our audio ads. That lift was something that we can then attribute, even if it's a correlation, to audio. And with that lift, we had enough good math to show when there's an increase in search, there's an increase in downstream, and then blah, blah, and then, you know, get to the revenues. And that's how we convinced finance to give us the investments that we needed to invest in audio. And we did it. And guess what? The answer was, it's great. It's working. We knew it. We didn't have the math. And then we finally did.
And also the math and the attribution, I think some part of that is a lot of lack of education around how it can and cannot be measured. Now, you know, Rose, you're up to speed now. You know that audio is every bit measurable as any other parts of digital now. And some part of it is that a lot of these definitions, these click-throughs, and happen to be very like social or digital metrics. And so when some folks will say audio doesn't have the measurability, it's because you don't have the same metric, obviously, because you're comparing eyes to ears. So they're slightly different, right?
But yes.
But that's at play too. And you know, you've done a phenomenal job. I think you were that person who was able to see beyond the numbers. You were able to understand the impact. And, you know, you navigated very well through your ecosystem, a large one, to make your case, lobby for it, and win. So congratulations for that.
Thank you. And one thing, you know, like I said, I'm going to plug myself right here, but there's a reason I wrote a book on how to essentially, it's the Renaissance Marketer's Shortcut to get finance to say yes and. It's part of a series. It's meant to be, we're getting all these different stakeholders, data, legal, everybody to say yes and. Mm-hmm. But the first book is to get finance to say yes and, because I've learned, just being a marketer for so long, that in every business leadership, their right-hand person is their CFO, is their finance person. And it's the how much can they invest in marketing to drive future growth that is always the question. And as a marketer, we can't actually do any of the things of influencing our customers, of understanding our customers, or investing in research and data and new platforms or old platforms that are new again. Like, we can't do any of that without the buy-in of finance. And I think marketers, and maybe I'm on a soapbox right now, but I think marketers in the last, like, I don't know, 20, 30 years have shied away from being closer to their finance partners and instead have said, no, 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 I don't touch numbers. No, 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 I don't talk about the investments or do the return on investments. And I'm more creative. I do the beautiful creative aspect. And I think that's been the miss.
Well, two things. One, I think there's a perception from anybody who's not in a CFO role that their job is to say no. Whatever's put in front of them, no, because their job is to control the purse strings. And there's, you know, oh, I can't ask finance because they always say no. The second thing is, you guys are actually inspiring me. I think a future episode would be really fascinating is to have a CFO on and ask them, what are some ways marketers, you know, can get that yes, right? And understand their thinking.
100%. And actually, in my book, I did do a bit of that. It's a go into and talk to CFOs and other business leaders and ask them exactly, like, what do you think of marketing? And what can marketing be doing better to help you? The surprising answer to this is actually, and I was surprised, was that CFOs actually really think marketing is powerful. What they're missing and what they've said repeatedly is, we want to understand the return though. Yeah. And that's what marketers have shied away from for years. It's like, we don't want to tell you how much audio campaign and podcasting can do for us in the future. We just want to tell you it will at some point, but we won't tell you when or do that hypothesis.
But why the fear, guys? Why do you think there's such reticence to do this?
I think, you know, honestly, from my end, I think it's mostly because there's nervousness around, if you say it's going to take a lot longer, and oftentimes everything is done, at least big businesses are done on a quarterly basis, you're not going to get that investment, right? If you're like, if this is going to take me 3 years to get the payback, but we're going to get 10x the payback, someone on finance might say, well, we got to close some gaps in the next quarter and we just won't give you that investment. So I think there's a fear of not getting what they want. But then I think the reality is, when you then don't give finance, then the answer is no, because like, you don't even have like a starting point of an ROI.
You know, what I've also noticed is when we get very, or brands or, you know, marketers get very focused on the short-term return, right? There is this fine balancing act between brand marketing and performance marketing as well. And, you know, the seat that I have and the conversations that I have, I often see that there is this tug of war between the two. And just because brand marketing is not something that you can see immediate impacts on, but if ignored long enough, going to be extremely hard to repair. And it's going to take you 2 times more the investment to get back to those levels. And so if you notice just around you in the last 5 years, I can like point out 5 brands who've actually pulled money out of the immediate performance marketing channels and have started to reallocate some of those funds to the top of the funnel brand marketing efforts because they recognized that growth started to get stunted. So the point you're making is a really good one, because what you're saying is, as a marketer, make sure your hands are in analytics and data, but your hands are also with your CFO, that you're constantly showing them the return on the investment, but then make a smarter case to also show that it's not just the short-term immediate. If you take your eye away from brand marketing, if you take your eye away from demand generation, not just demand fulfillment, then over time, you're going to spend three times more to make up for what you did not spend.
100%. I'll give you a stat that I keep using with both my finance partners and us, and used it kind of everywhere, is McKinsey did a study of like 20,000 different customers, and it was their customer decision journey. And what they found was 2/3 of eventual purchases were of brands that were top of mind. So by the time a customer is like making that decision, like, do I choose this brand or that brand? 2/3 of the time, they're going to choose whoever was top of mind at the very beginning of their decision journey.
Oh my God, you have to send me this.
Yes, I will send it to you. But it's crazy because 2/3, that just means that all the work that we put into performance marketing at the end is only going to maybe influence 1/3 of the time, but 2/3 is all about that brand awareness, long-term marketing that, again, very hard to quantify, but is actually extremely important. And I agree with you. I think marketers need to do a better job of balancing between short-term and long-term. And this is why I've been pushing so hard on everyone adopting what I'm calling the Renaissance marketer mindset, which is really to be multidisciplined, so understand your stakeholders, what their needs and asks are. But then two is really think long-term with investment in mind, right? Marketers need to stop talking about budgets and spending. We need to talk about investing in the future and how this all works together. But also there are short-term milestones that we need to hit to be able to hit those long-term. And then we want to balance the art and the science of marketing. But we got to do all three of these pieces. We can't just do one. So that's kind of what I've been pushing.
I think very well said. And, you know, I'm waiting for the signed copy of your book so I can start reading it.
Thank you.
Make that too. One thing we have not addressed as we're talking about all these ideas and all the things marketers can do, and it's kind of an elephant in the room in this particular context, and that is, and I think we all know this, CMOs on average have the shortest average tenure in the C-suite. So how does that factor in, especially you said short-term and long-term, Rose? Oh, Hertha, I forget which one said it, but that's got to play a role in this. If I'm a CMO, I know I'm on a short leash, right? So how does a CMO, a marketer, balance that, knowing that I don't have a lot of time to play with in the first place?
That's literally something I've been doing my own personal research on all the time, because I'm starting to see, I see that a lot. And I see that with our leadership and the different leaders I've seen in the past. And I think the answer to that is, businesses, all the CEOs, all the GMs, they care about basically driving the business for today and the future. Their CFOs and their finance partners are looking at the P&L all day, every day, right? So the marketing leader, the CMO, technically is what's going to be creating the growth in the future. So it's not about the growth of tomorrow. It's about the growth in 6 months time, 12 months time, and et cetera. So I actually think the best marketing leaders I've seen are the ones who actually talk about marketing in the lens of the P&L. They actually talk about, we're going to do this thing to drive this much new customers that will then bring this much more revenues in the 6 month timeframe, the short term, and then the 12 to 24 month timeframe. And they actually work really closely with the finance team to build out these models, because then what they're putting themselves into is they're actually becoming the left hand of the CEO. Right, where the right hand is the CFO, the left hand is the CMO, because the CMO is going to create that growth and they're going to show it, but they're going to work with their CFOs to actually build the models to show that, and then basically have all of these strategies that says, this is then how we're going to grow that customer base. This is how we're going to keep them from leaving us, right? Like, and these are all the marketing strategies. So that's where I've seen CMOs who have gone past the very short 2 year tenure to like 3, 4, 5, 6, 10-year timeframe, because they're no longer just the creative functional leader. They're now a business growth leader that happens to be leveraging marketing strategies.
I think that's phenomenally said. I think that having, I have nothing to add. That's so well said. Like, it's like, boom.
Yeah. I think we're both in agreement with what you said, Rose, was spot on. And it comes up all the time, as you guys know. And I coach and work with CMOs constantly. It's number one thing I hear.
So. And actually, you know, Steve, this is like maybe a plug for you to plug to all the CMOs you work with and talk to, is I think sometimes it would be helpful for the CMOs to embrace that and then have it trickle down to their organization, because that's where I've seen tremendous power in marketing organizations, is when the marketing leader is like, let's be besties with finance. Let's do this. Let's do these models. Let's do all of this. And then they actually, that kind of trickles to the rest of us. And then we start doing that as well. Whereas I've also seen marketing leaders only focus on the creative aspect. And as a result, even if they had people beneath them that are quote unquote Renaissance marketers, they don't have the leeway to be able to make those changes. So that's what I would love, Steve, if you can maybe, you know, give them a little nudge to remind them, like, it does start from the top. So we need them to do that heavy lifting of working closer with finance.
Consider it done. Well, listen, guys, we're coming up against it, and I want to leave time to kind of wrap up. Rose, for our listeners, I know we've talked about it, but can you please tell everybody the name of your book and where they can get it?
Yes. The name is The Renaissance Marketer's Shortcut to Get Finance to Say Yes And, and it's available on Amazon.
Excellent. Hital, anything you want to promote?
No, I think just my shameless promotional plug is Be data inspired. Look at the data for who you're trying to reach, and don't let human bias creep in.
Listen, guys, this has been amazing, phenomenal. I'm running out of superlatives, right? First time I've had two guests on, and it could not have gone any better. I cannot thank you guys enough.
No, thank you, Steve, for bringing us here, allowing us to be on your platform and promoting us. And I think, you know, we appreciate all the work you do to get the word out there too.
Yeah, no, thank you, Steve. And thanks for letting us gab about this, because I'm sure if you don't stop us, this would be all day. We just keep going and going.
Trust me, you have no idea how hard it was for me to not chime in, because I'm a conversationalist. So, but I know when to, exactly, Hital was just zipping her lip. You can't see that, but I knew when to be quiet. And I'll leave it at that. So, guys, thank you again. And I look forward to a part two.
Yeah, same here.
Likewise.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up another episode of the CMO Whisperer Show. I hope you shared this episode with your friends. And if you have not already, please subscribe to be kept up to date on all the latest episodes. And if you're so inclined, leave me a review on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you.